Okay, last week we sort of ended with Leo crowning Charlemagne emperor of the great Roman Empire, and we talked about some of the changes that had happened in the Christian church from Acts 2 up to the point that it was there in 800 when Charlemagne was crowned. And so tonight we're kind of going to pick up. I thought we were going to get a little further along, but you know, it's the problem of me teaching this class. There are some things I think, oh gosh, we really do need to cover, and so things get pushed off. So we're still in the medieval period. We're sort of in the middle medieval period right now, 800, and we'll get through probably the 10th century, maybe the 11th century tonight, and we'll talk next week about Thomas Aquinas, one of the great minds of whether you agree with his theology or not. He was one of the great minds of the medieval period, and scholasticism, it was part of the thing I talked about last time about this pendulum that swings back and forth in Christian history from emotional based Christianity to intellectually based Christianity, and we'll talk about the Crusades. But tonight we're going to take a look at some stuff, and while all this stuff was happening with Pope Gregory and Pope Leo and Charlemagne and all this stuff, over in an obscure little place in what is now Saudi Arabia and on the Arabian Peninsula, around 610, there was this merchant. He was in his 40s or so, and he received revelations from the angel Gabriel. And his name was Muhammad, and the things that Gabriel was telling him was that there's a single God, and this God rules over everybody, and he wants everybody to obey his rule. Now, Muhammad was a merchant. He had interaction with both Jews, with Christians. He had interaction with a whole lot of Christianity. Remember how we talked about that. You know, this idea of Nicene Christianity or this one view of Christianity really wasn't the case. That you had Arian Christianity out there, you had various views of Christianity. The same thing with Judaism as well. I mean, you've got, not everybody was singing out of the same hymnal through history. And so Muhammad would have had interaction with all this. And initially, in the purest form, what he was seeing was that these revelations he got from the angel Gabriel about this single monotheistic God was that it was not a brand new religion. It was the completion of what was going on with all this Christianity and Jewish stuff. And it's interesting how kind of this a similar thing happened in Christianity. If you remember the story when Paul got to Ephesus and all the silversmiths wanted to run him out of town because he started to hurt the economy with all this stuff he was teaching. Well, the same thing sort of happened to Muhammad. The area where he was there in Mecca was not a monotheistic a theology. Okay, there were a lot of gods. And in fact, a lot of the folks in Mecca made their living making these little god statues and stuff. Mecca was also known to have a stone that was worshipped at the time. Popular story about it was that it had come out of the Garden of Eden, actually, who had been brought now. But anyway, so this was in Mecca. And so you had this whole business of people making money off of making idols and stuff. And non-American idols, which we'll watch in a couple of hours, but making all these idols, and Muhammad comes along and he says, no, there's only one God. And he preached a stringent monotheistic idea. Well, that really ticked off all these merchants, who Muhammad was a charismatic guy. A lot of folks started flocking to him, and these revelations he was getting from the angel Gabriel, and it was starting to cut into the merchants' business. And it was hurting their pocketbook, which, you know, that's one of the big motivators of history is economics. And these guys didn't like it, and so they were looking to get rid of Muhammad. So Muhammad realized this, smart guy, packed his bags, got out of Dodge. And he went to this place, this other little town just sort of north of Mecca up there, which at the time, actually in 622, was just a little oasis kind of joint. It wasn't a big city. It would later on become a bigger city called Medina. And the flight to Medina is a very important date in Islamic history. Most folks who are historians in the West and whatnot will date the Islamic era as beginning in 622, when Muhammad fled to Medina. And he stayed there. He developed more of the theological positions and whatnot that he would teach. And he assembled a great number of followers. And he kind of got his own army up. And he was strong enough that he went back to Mecca. And he basically shows up in town and says, okay, here's the dealio, guys. You can get on board with this whole monotheistic thing that I'm doing and convert, and we can all do just fine, or I can pretty much conquer you because I've got now my own army and I've got a lot of strength. The merchants there went, hey, we're good with that. And so they converted, and Muhammad allowed everybody to have clemency, and everybody was fine. But that sort of thing set the pattern for how Islam spread. Now, after Muhammad died, as with any, you have a main leader and then other folks follow along afterwards, and some of them are really good and some of them aren't and whatnot, but Islam started to spread. And it spread from that one little place there in Saudi Arabia, it spread up north and it spread sort of to the west, and it became the dominant force in the Middle East. And then it spread down along the top of Africa, northern Africa, and it became dominant in northern Africa. And then when it got to the sort of the end of Africa, it jumped up there into Spain. Okay, and it became dominant in Spain. Well, that has two impacts on the history of the Christian church. One, it stopped the Eastern church from having the ability to expand. Because now the Eastern wing of the Christian church, and remember, at this time, the church had not split into two. At this time, it was still one united church, Western and Eastern wings of it. Well, it stopped the Eastern wing from being able to expand. The Eastern wing could not go south. The Eastern wing could not go east because it was surrounded by Islamic territory. The only thing the Eastern wing could really do is go north. It did that fairly successfully. It went into the Slavic nations. It ended up going up into Russia, converting Russia. Russian Orthodox Church is the Russian version of the Eastern Orthodox Church, of the Greek Orthodox Church. So it kind of went north and whatnot, but it really didn't have a lot of expansion. It couldn't go west because Rome was in west, and that's where the western wing of the church was, which was frustrating because Rome really wanted to take over the east, and Constantinople really wanted to take over Rome. And we'll see in a little bit these two battle back and forth for a while. The question is, when's this happening? Flight to Medina was 622. Over the course of the next couple of hundred years, this occurred. So we're looking at, now this starts to get us concurrent with the time we talked about last week, 800 or so, 800, 900. So this happened over a period of time. The other thing that it affected the Christian church is that a lot of the places that the Arab conquest, that the Islamic conquest, held now were sites that were holy historical sites for the Christian church. Jerusalem, Damascus, Alexandria down in the north of Africa. Suddenly these places that had been Christian holy places were now in the hand of Muslims. And so the Christian church was going to deal with that. Well, next week that's what prompts the Crusades, right? They want to sort of rescue these holy sites. It's fascinating to me that this stuff is still being argued over today. I mean, you know, if you think about it, not that history is cyclical or anything like that, but it's just some parts of history just never resolve. And, you know, I mean, they're still battling over Jerusalem. They are. They're still battling over the West Bank. They've been battling over that area since, you know, 800 AD. You know, so you know, some things in history never resolve themselves. So you've got that. Now that really affected a lot of what we'll see later on. It certainly affected it. It was the basis for the Crusades. It affected how Constantinople in the Eastern Church interacted with the West because they couldn't go any place. They really only had the West to go. Okay. Now, so that's going on. We'll put that on the back burner for a while. Get back to the Christian church. Leo, we talked about last week, crowned Charlemagne. Gregory was, I think, one of the great popes. Leo, I think, was one of the great popes. It's interesting, you know, Calvin loved Pope Gregory. Now this, I always love this, that this is where nowadays people that want to put folks in little neat boxes and dislike anybody that's not in your own box. You know, Calvin said that Gregory was the greatest pope. He was the last great pope. Calvin's certainly not going to like the popes that were around during the Council of Trent, because that's who he was battling theologically. But he liked Gregory. And you know, Leo was a pretty good guy, you know, crowning Charlemagne and whatnot. And the papacy got immense power because of that. But the problem with that is that immense power frequently corrupts. And after Leo died, the papacy started a downhill spiral, and it got very, very, very corrupt. Because it was an important office, people wanted to hold that office, but not for the right reasons. You know, today, well, in modern history, the guys that are pope are honest guys that you know, they're good guys. You know, they're not evil. They're not corrupt. They're not taking money on the side. They don't have illegitimate children. They are honestly good religious men. You can disagree theologically, but you cannot disagree with their character. But that wasn't the case here. You know, from 800 to about 1,000. Yeah. Oh, he just thought he was good, that what he did was both his policy as well as some of his theological points were good. My personal belief is he liked Gregory because Gregory liked Augustine, and there was that whole issue between Augustine and Pelagius, and in terms of the ideas of predestination and whatnot. So I think that's probably where Calvin went. I could look up exact quotes on that. I haven't in a while read through that, but I know that Calvin did like Gregory. So the papacy, because of people wanted it, and they wanted it for the wrong reason. They didn't want to be pope for religious reasons. They wanted to be pope because it was powerful, okay? And you had money. And actually, during this period of time, you could get girls, which we all know are the three big motivating factors for men in history, right? Power, money, and girls. And otherwise, nobody would ever become a rock star, right? And so the papacy started to decline. And it's really unfortunate, because it's almost now, when we look back at it, I'm going to tell you some stories just to show examples of this, but it's almost like a bad soap opera on TV during this period of time. It was common to assassinate the pope if you didn't like it. Now, I'd already told you how Leo was beaten up. They tried to gouge his eyes out, cut his tongue out, right? Because they didn't agree that with Leo being pope. But this got really bad during this period of time. Examples of this, Pope John VIII, he was assassinated. And the story is that his assassin poisoned him, but the poison didn't work quick enough, so he took a big club and bashed his head in. You know, you got to make sure this, right? Pope Stephen VI was a very corrupt guy, and just to give you an idea of how, I know this is different for us. We just don't see people acting this way today. But Pope Stephen disagreed with one of the previous popes, Formosus, and he actually, after Formosus died, a little while later, Stephen had them dig him up. They dressed the guy's body up in the full papal robes, and they put him on trial. Now, since dead people really aren't good at defending themselves, he lost, and they found him guilty. And so they paraded this dead pope's disinterred body through town, and then they hacked the body up. They dismembered it, and they threw the pieces in the river.
They didn't burn it?
No. No, they did that to Wycliffe. I'm just showing the level of human corruption that had gone into the church at this period of time. Okay, my favorite one is Sergius III, just because that's a cool name. But Sergius III, this is one of those Lifetime Channel movies that you see in the evenings. Sergius III was a pope who did something a lot of popes did. He had a mistress. And he actually had an illegitimate child by this mistress. And he had killed off the two previous guys that were trying to get to be pope, so he could be pope. And then after he died, his mistress, who had taken a husband, decided they wanted to control the papacy. So she and her husband and Sergius's illegitimate child stormed the papal palace. I mean, the popes were living in fortresses because it was dangerous being pope during this period, right? And they stormed it, they grabbed the pope, and they imprisoned him for a period of time, and then they killed him. And then they put the illegitimate child of Sergius III as pope. You know, he ended up getting killed and dying off and a bunch of these other... But that group, actually, Sergius's mistress and her husband, sort of formed a dynasty that several people who claimed to be pope during this period of time came out of that line. Modern day, and you know, Protestant church really doesn't keep track of who the popes were. The Catholic Church does, and they rightly distinguished during this period of time that a lot of guys who claimed the office of papacy never really were pope. And so when you see the list, you sort of have two lists. You have a list of who was legitimately pope, and then you have the list of everybody who claimed to be pope. And you'll find there are always more names on that claim to be than there are in the legitimate list. And so during this time, you have a lot of guys who are very corrupt, who are buying the papacy, who are having illegitimate affairs and children, and who are killing each other off. And it's just an ugly time in the church. Towards the end of this, the emperor steps in and starts to actually say, no, I'm going to now pick who gets to be pope. Because they've got to get some control over this, because it's just so out of hand. And about 250 years after Charlemagne was crowned in 800, the emperor at the time, Otto III, was... started to name the popes. He started to claim who they were. And then after he died, the next emperor, and you get up to Henry III, who was emperor, and he said, okay, I'm going to name this guy named Bruno from Toul. I hope I pronounced that correct, T-O-U-L. I always worry with some of these names that I'm not pronouncing correct. But Bruno was a really good guy, and he refused to be pope because he said, I don't want to be named pope by the emperor. I want to be named pope by the acclamation of the church and by the people. And Henry said, okay, that's good. Let's do that. So Bruno went into Rome to see if he could be elected pope, because he didn't want to be pope just by the emperor, which is, I've got to tell you, is an outstanding thing compared to how the popes are in this time. Okay, that Bruno was a good guy. On the way, he picked up a couple of companions, a guy named Humbert and a guy named Hildebrand. And Humbert and Hildebrand were, we'll talk about Humbert in a minute. Humbert was a little different. But these two guys came out of the monasteries. Now, at the same time the papacy was declining, monasteries were getting pretty bad too. Monasteries under Gregory and under Leo were good places, but then they just got corrupt like everything else. You have to understand, this was a real rough and tumble time, okay? The Middle Ages was almost every man for themselves. I liken it to a lot like how after the Soviet Union collapsed, if you talk to people that lived over there, it gets real ugly, and there's a lot of political infighting, and people are on the dole because, honestly, folks just want to put bread on the table for their family, and so if they can do it under the table or on the side or be a little sneaky or just... And that's the kind of stuff that was happening. So anyway, monasteries got very corrupt. They abandoned the rule of St. Benedict. Everybody started living on their own. Monks suddenly were, you know, drinking and eating and fat and happy, unlike the way they had been. A reform movement in monasticism started, okay, and it went back to a strict observance of the rule of Saint Benedict, and it went back to a much stricter observance of daily life of a monk than it was back under Gregory that we had talked about earlier, and they really cleaned house in the monasteries. Well, these two guys, Hildebrand and Humbert, the Bruno's buddies, were part of this monastic reform movement. And these were good guys. And they, well, okay, Humbert, the jury's out on him. But anyway, they came down with Bruno. Now, Bruno says, I don't want to be appointed by the emperor. I want to become pope I want to be elected. I want people to say yes, they want me. And he comes into Rome dressed as a penitent, barefoot, same with Humbert and Hildebrand, and they come marching into Rome. Well, word had gone out ahead of this, and everybody liked Bruno. And the people actually sort of lined the roads, and they were cheering him when he came in. Popular stories attributed miracles to him and whatnot. And he was unanimously acclaimed pope. He became Pope Leo IX. I should just point out at this point, most folks have one name, and when they become pope, they take another name. Okay, that was common. It's still common today. I mean, you know, Cardinal Wojtyla became Pope John Paul II, right? So, you know, everybody, Benedict VI is not, 16th is not the name of the current pope. Okay, he took that name when he. It's very common when you go into a religious order to take another name. Okay, and that happened back then. So anyway, Bruno became Leo IX, and he started to clean up the papacy, along with Hildebrand and Humbert. And two of the things that they found was a real problem with the papacy, I mean, besides all these assassinations and murders, was the fact that people wanted to buy the office of pope. You know, if you're rich enough and you're important enough and you're in the nobility, well, then I should be able to sort of acquire being pope. I should be able to buy that. And the other thing was that went hand in hand with this was that the clergy was not fully celibate. Remember I said that back under Pelagius II, back in 550 and around in there, he really clamped down on celibacy. He wanted celibacy. And then Gregory came along and said, now we need to loosen it back up. And so you had folks being married. And part of the problem was is that you had the things like Sergius III, where he dies, but his kid, in his case illegitimate, then becomes pope. And what happens is when you can buy the office if you have enough money, and when you can be married and start your own family, then it makes sense that it's going to be a corrupt line. Because if I've got enough money, I want to make sure when I die, my kid takes over the family business. If the family business happens to be the papacy, then nobody else can get there. Now, it was interesting that within society, this is a point where you have feudal society, okay? You have, you know, all the fairy tale stuff is based on this, right? Shrek, the whole, you know, you got a king and you got a kingdom, and you've got the people who have the money, and you got the soldiers, and then you got the merchant class, and then you've got the folks working in the field. And the folks working in the field are never going to be king, unless they happen to marry the princess and it's a fairy tale, right? That's just how it is. There was no real upward mobility. That's strange for us here in America, because we still, no matter how much you want to complain about stuff, I honestly know that anybody at any point in time, if they really try, they can get to a better place in the society. It is still true today that anybody essentially can grow up to be president. I mean, that's like saying back in the medieval period, anybody could grow up to be king. Well, you couldn't. Well, that's what Leo IX was trying to avoid, this ridiculous idea that we could create dynasties of rich people who would perpetuate the office of the papacy with their kids. And so he worked really hard to enact laws and to make sure that none of this stuff could happen. And he was very successful at this. Okay. In fact, following his death, popes coming after him continued this reform, and they finally got to the way of how now that the pope is chosen. And this came out of this period of time. They enacted the idea that the pope should no longer be appointed by an emperor, or simply whoever was the richest guy or whose dad was pope two popes ago or something, but that the pope should be elected by the men in the church, by the other bishops, and then it should be ratified by the people. Okay, and today, I don't know if you know this or not, the way the pope is elected is when the pope dies, all the bishops go to Rome. Now there's, within the Catholic Church, there's different levels of authority, and everybody is a bishop, but certain bishops are cardinals. Okay, and cardinals are, it just comes from a Latin term, an old Latin term, just means primary or primary bishop. So the cardinals are the ones, the College of Cardinals, as they call it, they're the ones who get together and they elect the pope. Oh, I honestly don't know the number of the current number of the College of Cardinals.
I mean, is it dozens or hundreds or thousands?
No, it's not hundreds of thousands. It's probably Oh gosh, I'm trying to think. I bet you it's between 50 and 100.
Oh.
I honestly don't know that number.
No, it doesn't matter.
But no, it's not like 1,000 guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does Pope come out of those cardinals?
He can. He doesn't have to. Normally he does. The past several popes have come out of that.
If he doesn't come out of there, where does he come from?
They could choose anyone they want to. They could choose an obscure person. Several popes in modern history what happens is, well, this is getting us off track, I'm sorry, but it's kind of cute the way this works. You have people start handicapping. After the pope dies, everybody starts handicapping the race. And I swear it's like you're going to Vegas to put the line on who's going to win the Kentucky Derby. Okay, and you see these news commentators on TV, guys who are just, well, not well informed. Well, I understand that you know, Bishop so-and-so from Croatia is probably going to be the next pope because we think that he's blah, blah, blah. And I understand this guy, and I think this guy. And what's amazing to me is that frequently they're wrong. The really great popes of the 20th century, the modern period, right, from Pope Pius VI forward, let's say, John the 23rd was an awesome pope. He was the guy that really brought the Catholic Church into the modern period. In the 60s, he was the one that started Vatican II. He was an obscure guy. He just came out of nowhere. But he was a great guy. You look at John Paul II, another guy. He was not on the, well, he might have been on the list because he was fairly prominent because of his work against communism within Central Europe. But he was a guy they didn't expect. The guy prior to him, who died very quickly, I mean 2 days in office or something, he kind of came out of nowhere too. So you find that usually that list that the handicappers put together of who's going to win frequently is way off. But again, it's chosen from the College of Cardinals chooses the Pope. Well, that started back in this period of time. And I like to read to you guys the stuff that was written at the time. In 1059, so this would have been 259 years after Leo crowned Charlemagne emperor. In 1059, Pope Nicholas II finalized of how the pope should be elected. And this is important because you have to remember, there was no Baptist church in 1059. Everybody in 1059 was Christian. You were Christian under Rome, or you were Christian under Constantinople in the East. There was no division of the church. Okay, so sometimes when you read this stuff, people say, "Well, why are you reading me the history of the papacy? I don't care. I'm not Catholic." Everybody was Catholic prior to the Reformation. Okay, everybody was Catholic prior to 1045 when the church split East and West. Okay, so this is the history of our church. I mean, this is part of it. Nowadays we don't follow this because we're the Protestant wing of the church. But I'm saying that this period of time, so that's why this stuff's important. So Pope Nicholas II decreed that on the death of the pontiff of this Roman Universal Church, the cardinal bishops, there the term is used correctly, and that would mean the primary bishops, shall first confer with most diligent consideration, and then shall come in the summon the cardinal clergy, the other bishops, other priests and whatnot, to join them. And afterwards, the rest of the clergy and the people shall give their assent to the new election. It's done so that the least disease of venality creep in by any means. Godly men shall take the chief part in the election of the pontiff, and the others shall follow their lead. This method of election is regular in accordance with the rules and decrees of the fathers. So the goal of this was to avoid these terrible, corrupt misuses of the pope that had occurred after Leo. Up to Leo the Ninth, these terrible. I'm buying it. I'm putting my kid up there. They elected a 15-year-old kid pope at one point. Okay, that's how. I mean, a 15-year-old kid running the entire Christian church. That's just ridiculous. Okay, but it was that corrupt, and Nicholas II enacted this, and he was just at the end of the trail of this. It started with Leo the Ninth, of how to get the church back on track here, and that's what the goal was. Yeah, question.
You said that everybody was Catholic until when?
Well, technically, everybody was Catholic until 1054, which was in about 10 minutes. I'm going to tell you about why 1054 is important. That's when the church split east to west.
Okay.
After that, all of us in the West, because we're all Western Christians here, everybody was Catholic then, still, until until the Reformation. And it really, technically, it wasn't until the Council of Trent, which was the Catholic Counter-Reformation, it was the Catholic Church addressing the issues of the Reformation, where the reformers were excommunicated, that it wasn't until that point in time, which was the 16th century, that you, then you had the split between the Protestant and the Catholic, which is what we have today. So today you have three branches of Christianity. You have the Roman Catholic Church, you have the Protestant Church, and then you have the Eastern Church. Eastern Church is from 1054. The Catholic Protestant split is from the 16th century, from the Council of Trent. And so, but prior to this, all of our great 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 grandparents in the faith, everybody was Catholic up until that time. Coptic Christians are Christians primarily from the East in Egypt. They fall under the Eastern branch of the church. Yeah. And they still share today common theological views of the Eastern branch of the church, but they're primarily Egyptian Christians today, hugely persecuted. Oh my goodness, the Coptic church, it's brutal persecution. And you know, that never hits the headlines. I swear, it is amazing to me that the brutal persecution of Christians, of the Coptic Christians, of Christians in the various stands, okay, the Kyrgyzstan and Gugulmenistan or wherever these different ones are, that they are brutally, I mean, they're slaughtered. It's terrible today.
Right now, they protest in front of the White House. Right now, they're seeking support from the White House because the persecution has just gotten so bad.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It's
yeah,
horrible.
It's absolutely terrible. Yeah. And I'll tell you, the Coptic Church down there has done a huge amount for Christianity in the last 50 to 60 years. So, you know, the Coptic Church was the one that supported the UNESCO archaeological digs for Nag Hammadi, which unearthed, whether you agree with it or not, it unearthed huge amounts of things that are critically important to the history of Christian theology. They unearthed the Gospel of Thomas, all the Nag Hammadi material, and the Coptic Church is great in that respect. And yeah, the persecution is just brutal.
And they're also growing by leaps and bounds right now.
Yeah, it is interesting that the
Christians,
yeah,
the Christian church in Egypt, they said so many Muslims are converting, so much so that Mubarak had to put some kind of thing in some kind of order or something to prevent the prevent the people from converting to Christianity.
Yeah, there is a lot. The Egyptian church, the Coptic church, is very active now. The major Coptic church in this area is right down off of McFadden and between New Hope and Euclid in Fountain Valley, actually. It may be Costa Mesa, I'm not sure where the line is drawn. And several years ago, the Pope of the Coptic Church, they have a head leader just like the Orthodox Church has the Patriarch. The Patriarch of the Coptic Church actually came there and dedicated that church. It was a huge event for the Coptic Church in America.
And they're the same as Greek, they're different from Greek Orthodox?
Different than Greek Orthodox, yeah. They share some common theological things, which date back to this thing I'm going to talk about now. During this period of time,
1054?
Yeah, well, yeah, we're a little bit prior to 1054, but right prior to June 16th, 1054. We're going to talk about the probably 50 years, 100 years before that now. Both the Eastern, you had one church, but you had two wings. You had the Eastern wing and the Western wing. It's like, you know, the NFL, or the NFC and the AFC, okay? Yeah, it's like the American League and National League, okay? But these guys kept sticking their fingers in each other's business, okay? Now, when somebody was coming into town to burn the joint down because they were a marauding invader from outside, they always called on the other side to help out. The minute that threat was gone, they started sticking their fingers into each other's business and fighting. It was a lot like siblings, you know? And they battled over a lot of different issues. And they got in each other's business, and it just got kind of ugly. And again, the Eastern Church was cornered by this big, you know, to the south they couldn't go because you had the Arab conquest, to the east they couldn't go any further. They would have loved to have gone over into Rome. Rome said, no way, this is our joint, we're not giving up power to you. In fact, we want to take over power there. And so you have this stuff, it just starts going back and forth. And it starts getting serious because they start they start just arguing back and forth over theological issues, but behind the theological issues, there were political issues. And this is something important to understand about church history. As much as we would like to think that it is purely theological issues, it never really is, okay? It always, 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 always involves some sort of either national or political interplay, okay? Whether it starts as a theological issue and then it gets supported, people choose sides based on politics or national issues, or whether it starts as that and a theological issue comes along, when you look at church history, it's always these kind of things. The Reformation had a whole lot to do with Germany being angry at Italy and back and forth, as well as the theological issues of the Reformation. You know, Germany was more than happy to keep Martin Luther safe so he couldn't be killed by the Italians because Germany didn't like Italy. And so, you know, a lot of these guys, I mean, let's face it, politicians for a good measure are not theologians, they're politicians, right? So in Rome, in Constantinople, you're a politician, you're not a theologian, you know? And so a lot of this stuff gets intertwined, and you've got a battle for power between Rome and Constantinople. Now, Leo IX is a good pope. He's cleaning the joint up. But these issues are coming up. And it sort of started, the one that really sort of started bugging people was this idea of the use of icons. In the East, they used icons. Well, everybody did. Rome used statuary and icons and whatnot. But in the East, they started to argue over whether you should use icons or not. And it divided into two camps. Clearly, people that thought you should use icons and folks that thought you shouldn't. They were called the iconoclasts and the iconodules. The iconodules said we should use icons. The iconoclasts said we should destroy the icons and not use them. We have our modern day, if you're an iconoclast nowadays, okay, that means you're an idol destroyer. That's what that word means. It comes from this period of time. And the thought was, what do we do with images of Jesus and the saints? And some folks said, absolutely, we shouldn't have them because people are going to end up worshiping them like pagans do statues, and so we should just get rid of them. Then the other side said, no, no, no. Images of Jesus and the saints are okay because, let's face it, Jesus is a physical image of God, right? Jesus is God, the God-man, right? And so why would God take human form if he would be upset with us making pictures of Jesus? I mean, what's wrong with that? And they said it's possible to actually have these pictures of Jesus or of the saints and to use them as guides to our worship or to allow us to have visual images that would draw us closer to God. And it isn't idol worship like the pagans creating some statue that they would worship that statue. And so this battle raged back and forth over and over. And Rome actually ignored it a lot. I mean, Constantinople put out a decree, no idols. And Romans said, forget you, we're just going to pay it. Or they'd say, yes, we can use idols. Forget. And they were actually, they finally came down, they argued, again, semantically, that there are two levels of worship. Okay, there's latria, which is the worship that is to God alone. Then there's dulia, iconodule, right? Dulia, which is a lesser form of worship. It's not worship that's given to God. It's sort of an honor. It's like we hang picture, or we used to, we don't anymore, but used to go into a schoolhouse and there'd be a picture of Washington and Lincoln hanging on the wall, or the American flag, you know, those kind of things. That's dulia. And they were okay with that. But you see, Rome kept kind of sticking their fingers in the argument in the East over these icons, and the East didn't like that. And the East kept trying to come in, and when you know, Rome would start getting beat up by some barbarian tribe, frequently the East would say, well, we're not going to help you guys. And Rome would, oh, but we're going to get beat up. No, we're not going to help you guys. In fact, we may try to take a little power here after you guys get beat up. So this is going back and forth. So finally we get up to the point, Leo IX is there. He's got his buddies Hildebrand and Humbert, and they're reforming the papacy. And all this stuff with the Eastern Church starts to get really ugly. And it gets ugly over four main issues. Okay, the four main issues that causes the schism are the authority of the Roman Pope. Rome says, you know what? I know that these are two wings of the same church, but I am more important here in Rome than you are, the patriarch over in Constantinople. Okay? And it's interesting, Publio was a good guy, but he got this wrong. There was a document, this is fascinating to me. There was this document called The Donation of Constantine. Now, this was a false document. Okay, this thing has been proved to be false. But Leo thought it was true. A number of folks did. Leo just wasn't making this up. But Leo thought it was true. And the Donation of Constantine tells the story of how Constantine, you know, essentially recognized that the Bishop of Rome has the greatest power within all of Christianity. Again, this was a fake, this was a false document that Leo thought was true. And I want to quote from it because it's real interesting. The Donation of Constantine, it's supposedly a deed from Constantine to Pope Sylvester. Okay, but within this is the Constantine recognizing that the Bishop of Rome is primary. And he says here in this document, says, and inasmuch as our imperial power is earthly, meaning the Roman emperor would be Constantine in this context, our imperial power is earthly, we have decreed that it shall venerate, the Roman emperor, shall venerate and honor his most holy Roman church, God's most holy Roman church, and at the sacred see, the name See, again, I talked about is the reference to the papacy. And the sacred See of Blessed Peter shall be gloriously exalted above our empire and earthly throne. Here, Constantine is saying that the Pope has authority even over emperors. We attribute to him the power and glorious dignity and strength and honor of the empire, and we ordain and decree that he shall have rule as well over the four principal sees, the four sections of the church. Antioch, Alexandria, Constantinople, and Jerusalem, and also over all the churches of God in all the world, and the pontiff, who for that time being presides over the most holy Roman church, shall be the highest and chief of all priests in the whole world, and according to his decision shall all matters be settled which shall be taken in hand for the service of God or the confirmation of the faith of Christians. So this document purports that Constantine is telling the Pope that he has authority over all the church, that the Pope in Rome. Leo the Ninth believed this to be correct. In fact, Leo the Ninth, in a minute I'll tell you, he sent this letter to Michael Celeralius, the patriarch in Constantinople, and he quoted this in that letter to say, look, I've got authority. This proves it. Well, this was a fake document. This thing wasn't real. So anyway, the authority of the Pope was an issue between the West and the East. Interestingly enough, a big issue was the kind of bread you use in communion. In the West, and we still do to this day, we use unleavened bread. All churches use unleavened... Well, okay, there are some sort of real loose Methodist churches out there that I think probably use sourdough or chocolate chip cookies or something, but for the most part, most churches use it's got to be gluten free because we don't want to have any allergies, right? But we use unleavened bread. In the East, they use leavened bread. When you to this day, you go to a Greek Orthodox church and frequently you'll find leavened bread. The communion, the little hosts are actually ready bread, right? It's not unleavened bread, and that was a big issue. That was huge. The East hated that the West used unleavened bread because they said that to this day you can go online and find these treatises against the use of unleavened bread by the Latin Church, as it's referred to from the East, right? The other one was celibacy. They thought celibacy was wrong in the East. And the West said, no, everybody's got to be celibate. Remember, celibacy came out of the reform movement that Leo was trying to push through as a way to keep the papacy from being corrupted, right? And the fourth thing was over the issue of the Trinity. They were still arguing over how we understand the relationship between the Holy Spirit and God the Father and God the Son. In the West, and we still say it to this day, when we say the Creed, we say the Holy Spirit who proceeds from the Father and the Son. In the East, they didn't like that. They wanted to only say the Holy Spirit who proceeds from the Father. So that and the Son was a huge issue. We're talking about the Coptic Church. You go to the Coptic Church here in Orange County, you'll hear it, the Holy Spirit who proceeds from the Father. Okay, they don't add the Son. You go to our churches, or any church that uses creedal statements, and you'll hear from the church from the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. That was the Roman Creed. Okay, so these were the four issues that everybody just was upset about. The authority of the papacy in Rome, what kind of bread you use at communion, celibacy of the clergy, and how the Holy Spirit relates to God the Father and God the Son. Well, Leo wants to just deal with this issue with Constantinople. And so he takes and sends his buddy Humbert over to Constantinople to talk to the patriarch. Now, Humbert was a good guy, and he was doing his best, but he was not the best guy to send over. One, Humbert didn't speak Greek. Okay, in the West, everybody spoke Latin at this time. But in the East, over in Constantinople, everybody spoke Greek. Now, Leo himself had said that he was trying to learn Greek so he could understand the correspondence better, but he sends Humbert over there, and Humbert doesn't have a lick of Greek going on. And, boy, when you kind of read some of the stuff, you kind of think that Humbert didn't get the whole cultural thing either. And he goes storming into town to say, okay, here's the deal. We're going to take care of this right now. Now, this is really weird to us, and I keep harping on this, and I'm sorry about that, but we look at the world through our glasses. We're 20th century, early 21st century people. A lot of us are late 20th century people, right? And we look at the world through that. You know, when Nixon went to China in the 70s, he didn't just get in a plane and say, oh, I'm going to go talk to these heathens. Right? He understood the importance of opening up China. He had folks all around him who said, this is what Chinese culture is like. You've got to do this. Right? Today, if we send an envoy to China to negotiate a trade agreement, we send a guy that knows Mandarin and Cantonese and who understands Chinese culture and who can go in there and negotiate. That's how we do business nowadays, right? I mean, that's what we do. We try to learn about the person we're negotiating with. We understand that culture. If there's a language barrier, we try to overcome it. That wasn't what happened here in 1054. In 1054, you got this reforming monk who gets sent over to straighten out the problem with Constantinople. Now, he takes with him this letter that Leo wrote. And Leo included his quote from the decree of Constantine in there. Right? And so he goes over with this and he presents it. And the patriarch of the church over there says, nah, I'm not going to go for that. That's stupid. He doesn't agree with this, right? Now, prior to this, the patriarch over in the East has already kicked out the Latin churches and shut them down. Okay, that's part of why this is getting ugly. Because now they're starting to say, you know what? If you're going to line up with Rome, then you're out of here. And Rome's kind of doing the same thing, but there's also issues that the emperor over in the East, the Eastern Emperor, remember you have an Eastern and Western Emperor at this time as well, has started to appoint who becomes the patriarch in the East. Constantinople is afraid that if the Pope is the supremacy that Leo is claiming, then they'll lose their authority because now the Western Emperor and the Western Pope will be dominant. So they're trying to protect their political authority as well. Okay, so Humbert goes over there, rolls into town, does a little bit of negotiating, and it just gets bad. It just doesn't go anywhere. And so Humbert either prepares or has with him the papal order of excommunication. And here's another thing. We look at this and we go, well, okay, you know, when you're going to take the nuclear option, normally it's done kind of out of the spotlight of the media, you know, unless there's paparazzi around. But, you know, if you're really going to take the nuclear option, you're going to do it in a room, right? Humbert waits until the middle of the church service where the Patriarch of Constantinople, the head of the Eastern Church, is about to do communion, and Humbert rolls down the center aisle of the church and slaps the notice of excommunication on the altar in front of him and says, I pronounce anathema on you. That's not the way you do business. That's not the Dale Carnegie how to win friends and influence people, right? Well, clearly the patriarch doesn't like this, right? That's pronounced, that means you're a curse, you're excommunicated. And I will read you some excerpts of it here.
It's kind of like the way we behave in Congress now.
Well, we don't behave nearly as bad as we used to. You know, Congress used to be, I mean, it's pretty bad now, but it was ugly. Prior to the Civil War, there was a Southern congressman who disagreed with his counterpart across the aisle, and he picked up his cane, went over there, and beat him to the floor unconscious. Now, that hasn't happened recently. I mean, they may call names, but nobody's beating each other over the head with a club. You know, so actually, we're pretty civil. And we don't look like, you know, I always love it when they run the clip on TV of the guys jumping on the thing and beating each other up in the somewhere like, yeah. I love that. They're just up there thumbing. And they're like baseball fights. They're bad fights. They're not like a hockey fight. Nobody's getting injured, right? But so anyway, Humbert goes in there and he says, you know, bam, that's it, Cyril Arias. You're out of here, right? And part of the decree, there were a number of points in it, but... he said, it was written, you are said to have publicly, he's talking about the Patriarch of Constantinople, you are said to have publicly condemned the Apostolic and Latin Church without either a hearing or a conviction. Well, and I think rolling into town in the middle of Mass and excommunicating the guy is kind of doing the same thing. But anyway, both sides are bad in this. And the chief reason for this condemnation, which displays, and I love the language here, displays an unexampled presumption and an unbelievable effrontery, is that the Latin Church dares to celebrate the commemoration of the Lord's Passion with unleavened bread. What an unguarded accusation is this of yours? What an evil of arrogance. I mean, this is amazing language, right? Whatever happened to Christian Brotherhood where we're all supposed to, you know, anyway. He says, you place your mouth in heaven while your tongue going through the world strives with human arguments and conjectures to undermine and subvert the ancient faith. In prejudicing the case of the higher see, the see on which no judgment may be passed by any man, you have received the anathema from all the fathers of all the venerable councils. Okay? You are in deep yogurt, Mr. Patriarch of Constantinople. Now, an interesting point of fact here. Humbert didn't know Leo had died. So technically, this thing had no weight, because when the Pope dies, the next guy has to either approve that or write a new one. So what Humbert didn't realize was that this whole thing he was slapping on the altar in front of the Patriarch was null and void, because the Pope was dead. Humbert didn't know that. He hadn't read his tweets that day. So now the Patriarch of Constantinople has decided that, you know what, I'm not putting up with this either. And now the popular story is that he excommunicated the Pope. Technically, he didn't. He didn't excommunicate Leo. He excommunicated Humbert. Okay, so that's actually when you look at it. So the Patriarch of Constantinople excommunicates Humbert, but effectively he's excommunicating who Humbert represents, who's the Pope in Rome. So on June 16th, 1054, right, or 1054, not 10,000, wow, that's way in the future. 1054, June 16th, the church now splits. This is the first time since the beginning of the church in Jerusalem on Pentecost that the church is split in two. It's irrevocable at this point. They tried twice to get the churches back together, but it's never happened. Okay. Now, modern period, the church in Rome has extended some openness to the Eastern Orthodox Church, and there was a decree of, and I do not have the full details on this. There was a decree regarding shared communion. I'm not sure how it's not fully open, but how far that went. But from this point in 1054, the church was completely split into two separate groups. That's a momentous event in the history of the church. Prior to that, so for 1,000 years, the church was united. It squabbled, it argued, it was corrupt, it sinned, it reformed, it sinned again, but it was always united. At this point, June 16th, 1054, the church was split in two, the Eastern Wing and the Western Wing, and they have never come back together. Okay? That was the first great split in the history of the church. The second one will be the Reformation. But from this time forward, we're really only going to look at the Western Wing of the church, because that's what our history is.
Did the Eastern Church ever have a Reformation-type event?
No, the Eastern Church had some interesting things go on. The Eastern Church had to deal with the Islamic conquest. Okay. The Eastern Church still had to deal a little bit with Rome. But the way society went within Europe, which we still consider that area of the Eastern Church part of Europe, this was the point where politically and influentially the East started to decline. And finally, when they're conquered by the Islamic invaders, most of the folks from the East flee to the West, which interestingly enough influences the Reformation. Because the influx of people from the East who were scholars, who understood the history of the Christian scriptures and who knew Greek, remember the West didn't have the Greek for years, it was Latin, started to reinvigorate a yearning in the West in the Renaissance for classical literature, for the study of the Greek writers, which promoted the idea of the Bible being translated out of Latin, which Luther would pick up, which others would pick up. So the East ends up having some influence much later on through sort of a convoluted way.
But this is not, the Greek that the Eastern Orthodox Church is speaking is not Koine Greek, right?
Not today, no.
No, but that they were speaking at that time.
It was shifting from the Koine period to the Byzantine period, yes.
Okay.
And so you have a shift in the language. It was not as radical a shift as you have between the Greek that's spoken today and Koine Greek.
Okay.
Greek has always been a bi-level language. It's always had its common form, and it's had its official form. To this day in Greece, there are two forms of the language. There's Demotic Greek, which is the common stuff that everybody just talks on in town. If you want to get a cab or go to a restaurant, you're going to speak that. There's the official language of the Greek church and the Greek parliament, which is a separate form of Greek. That's been the case for a long time. Attic Greek was the formal Greek, and Koine was the common Greek. Okay, so you've always had that split. But yes, they were not speaking the same group as the same way as Koine, but Byzantine Greek and Koine Greek are closer than Koine Greek and modern common Greek is. But you start to see the decline of the East at this point, and the movement upward of the West. And so from this point, most of our history is going to focus on the West. You know, we're going to talk about the Crusades. We're going to talk about the Reformation. These are all Western, essentially Western issues. Luther was not fighting with Constantinople. Luther was fighting against Rome. And Luther didn't want to split, by the way. Luther didn't want the Reformation to happen. Luther wanted to do what Gregory had done, what Leo IX had done. He wanted to see the church reformed. And it didn't happen. Again, because there are political and national issues. Germany versus Italy, all kinds of stuff going on. You have France versus Italy for a while when we get in the period where you have multiple popes and anti-popes. So again, there you have political and national stuff taking place. But tonight we get to what I think is a very ugly time in the history of the church, this split between the East and the West. And it continues to today. That's just what happened on June 16th with Humbert slapping the excommunication order on the altar. Still is, that's reverberating today. Okay, I kept you guys 3 minutes over. I'm sorry about that. So next week we'll start looking at the Crusades. We're going to look at Thomas Aquinas, Scholasticism, and a few other cool things here as we kind of get out of the medieval period up to the Reformation.
Okay, so when the Crusades hit, the Eastern Church is starting to, you said, come over into the West.
Well, no, later on in the Renaissance we find that the folks fleeing the Islamic invasions in the East start coming to the West.
I thought the Crusades was...
Crusades were in the 14th century.
was to take back...
Was to recapture the Christian holy places. Right.
From the Muslims?
Right, from the Islamic control, yeah. Yeah, that was the primary thing. There are other issues, but that's the popular history of it, yeah. So we'll start looking at that next week. Okay, see you guys in a week.